English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Reacts to U.S. expression of concern about Tehran-Beijing ties, saying that a flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East is accelerating the U.S. decline. The World Health Organization's warning about the consequences of the inequitable distribution of COVID vaccines around the world. The Suez Canal Authority says that a huge container ship blocking the busy waterway for almost a week has been partially refloated. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behram Sajafi. Good to have you with us. Beginning with our top story, the U.S. President has expressed concerns about the recently signed Iran-China Comprehensive Partnership Agreement.
Surging partnership between China and Iran.
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden was addressing reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. Tehran and Beijing signed a cooperation pact called the Sino-Iranian Strategic Partnership. It was signed during a visit by Chinese foreign minister to Iran. It includes cooperation in political, strategic, and economic fields. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has reacted to Biden's comment. Ali Shamkhani says that his concern is correct, as the flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East is accelerating the U.S. decline. I talked to writer and political commentator John Wyatt just an hour ago, and he says that President Joe Biden is concerned about the Iran-China deal, because it goes against this country's anti-Tehran sanctions and pressure.
When Biden said he's been concerned about this growing relationship between Iran and China for some time, let's be clear what he's concerned about. He's concerned about Iranian children having food on the table, and he would rather they did not have food on the table, because this, when all is taken into context, is what this is really about. The Iranian people have been suffering the depredations of US Caesar sanctions, as have the Venezuelan people, as have the Cuban people for over half a century, and as have the Syrian people as we speak. And Anthony Blinken and Joe Biden have succeeded with 100 days of their administration being in office of poisoning relations between the US and Russia to an all-time low, which is really saying something, and poisoning relations between Washington and Beijing to an all-time low, which is really saying something, though for different reasons than his predecessor, Donald J. Trump. So when it comes to human rights, the US has no leg to stand on. Indeed, 1 million Iraqi dead, thousands of Libyan dead, the people who are suffering the depredations of the sanctions I just described in Iran and Venezuela and Cuba, they make clear that the U.S. has no right to lecture any country on human rights at any time, anywhere.
The U.S. Secretary of State has threatened Russia with consequences over what he calls Moscow's malign activities against this country. Antony Blinken says the United States will take steps to defend its interests whenever it chooses to. He highlighted a shared commitment among U.S. and its Western allies to hold Russia accountable for its actions. Washington has refused to participate in virtual talks with Moscow to discuss their tensions, and that after President Biden called his Russian counterpart a killer. The U.S. accuses Russia of cyber attacks and of meddling in the November presidential election that Joe Biden won. Moscow has dismissed the allegations. Ties between the two have been tense, with several tit-for-tat actions taken against each other. Political analyst Greg Simon says the U.S. is a declining power that has a hard time backing its NATO allies in light of its tensions with Moscow.
Because they've made it clear that unreliable partner, they make assertions and assumptions, grandstanding, but there is nothing substantive. They can't even support their allies. They're threatening Germany with sanctions if they go ahead with supporting Nord Stream 2. They're not reliable for anyone at this stage because they're in decline. They understand it and they're doing everything. It's like someone who's drowning. They will put
World Health Organization is warning against a widening gap in COVID vaccine distribution across the globe. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says there is a growing gap between jabs distributed in rich countries and poor countries through the COVAX initiative. He denounced the unfair distribution of the vaccine, saying that it's economically and also epidemiologically self-defeating. Now that follows the criticism by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, has criticized developed countries for creating a stockpile of COVID vaccines. It says that a COVAX international system of vaccine aid to the disadvantaged countries is facing difficulties because there has been a lot of hoarding. Figures indicate more than half of the COVID-19 vaccines have been administered in high-income countries, which account for only 16% of the global population. A nighttime curfew has been imposed in the Gaza Strip while coronavirus infections continue to rise there. Early this month, the blockade at the region witnessed a second wave of the pandemic. Human rights groups have repeatedly warned of the catastrophic implications of the spread of coronavirus in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shannon has the story.
Local authorities in the blockaded Gaza Strip have imposed a nighttime lockdown as of Saturday to help combat the spread of coronavirus. Security forces are currently enforcing a curfew from 9 p.m. until 6 a.m. In recent days, the number of infections has risen to an alarming level. The impoverished enclave's fragile health system suffers from acute shortages of medicines and hospital supplies due to the illegal Israeli blockade. Hospitals in Gaza currently have less than 200 ICU beds and ventilators for nearly 2 million inhabitants.
Infections are rising by hundreds on a daily basis, and this is very alarming. We call on all people to adhere to preventive measures, especially wearing masks and social distancing.
Due to the Israeli blockade, Gazans are under terrible strain, and their worries over the coronavirus have been heavily compounded. Gazans are already struggling to make ends meet amid the punishing Israeli blockade.
Authorities have imposed a new lockdown to stop the spread of the virus, but the economy will suffer further. We are under blockade and most people are poor. If the lockdown is extended, day laborers like me will suffer more.
In late August 2020, a full lockdown was imposed on the Gaza Strip for a period of 2 weeks after authorities confirmed the first coronavirus cases spread through the community.
We are planning to impose further restrictions in the coming days to break the cycle of infection and protect the people in Gaza. The situation is very dangerous, and we expect a new spike in infections in the coming days. We will work hard with all institutions to flatten the curve of infection.
The ongoing Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is one of the main reasons why tackling the deadly coronavirus pandemic is particularly difficult.
People here are bracing themselves for the worst as coronavirus infections continue to increase. Experts have warned that a wider outbreak of the pandemic could be catastrophic. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The Egyptian president has announced the success of an operation to unwedge a giant container ship stuck in the Suez Canal for almost a week. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi says that the ship called Ever Given was unwedged despite the enormous complexity surrounding the process. The vessel became jammed diagonally across a southern section of the canal in high winds early last Tuesday. 370 vessels were waiting to transit the canal on either side of the blocked area. The incident created disruptions in the global shipping industry as around 30% of the world's shipping container volume moves through the Suez Canal daily. Two military convoys belonging to U.S. led forces have reportedly come under attack in central and southern Iraq. According to local media, one supply convoy was targeted in Babylon province, another one was hit in Qadisiyah. No media report of possible casualties or damage. Attacks have risen against U.S. forces and their supply convoys in Iraq in the past month. Tensions escalated after a U.S. strike near Baghdad killed top Iranian General Soleimani and Iraqi Commander al-Mohandas in 2020. The Iraqi parliament has already passed a resolution urging the government to put an end to the presence of American boots on Iraqi soil. In Mozambique, the authorities say that dozens of people were killed in coordinated raids by militants on Wednesday.
Over the past 3 days, the Defense and Security Forces have executed operative actions focused firstly on the rescue of hundreds of citizens, nationals and foreign, protection of citizens and their goods.
The raids took place in the town of Palma in the northern province of Cabo Delgado. Officials say the attacks forced the evacuation of thousands of survivors to safety in the provincial capital, Pemba. 7 people were also killed in an ambush during operations to evacuate hundreds of locals and foreigners. Now, that happened after an announcement by French energy group Total that it would resume work on a major gas project near Palma. Total now saying it has suspended the restart of its operations. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Asian Americans are the latest minorities in the United States to be a target of hate crimes. The recent surge in the number of attacks against people of Asian descent has provoked an outcry in the country. Now, what are the reasons behind the violence against the community, and how can it be addressed?
On Sunday, people across the United States held marches and rallies to denounce the recent rise in anti-Asian hate crimes in the country. Protesters hit the streets in New York, San Francisco, Portland, and several other cities to show solidarity with the Asian American community. The demonstrations were held days after a gunman attacked 3 spas in the U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, killing 8 people, 6 of whom were Asian women. The police are investigating whether the shooting spree was racially motivated, but the recent upsurge of verbal and physical attacks against the ethnic minority has raised serious concerns. The escalation of anti-Asian racism is attributed, for the most part, to the rhetoric adopted by former U.S. President Donald Trump after the novel coronavirus broke out in the country in March last year.
It's a disease, without question, has more names than any disease in history. I can name Kung Flu. I can name 19 different versions of names.
Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
Racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
But that's unlikely to be the only reason why the Asian community is increasingly coming under attack.
A lot of this anti-Asian violence and racism is has been simmering underneath the surface of the United States for centuries now. Trump is only a product or a symptom of what's been white nationalist and white supremacist legislation, policies, and ideologies that have existed within the U.S. since its foundation.
Last year saw waves of anti-racism protests across the U.S. re-sparked following the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis police officer. With Trump no longer in the White House, many hoped things would turn for the better. But it seems like the former president has made a lasting impression that's proving hard to undo.
A recent report published by the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism shows the instances of anti-Asian hate crimes in the U.S. soared by some 150% compared to the year before. Now, looking back at U.S. history, hate crimes have usually exacerbated during times of national crises, the most recent instance of which has been the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, given the fact that the U.S. houses expatriate communities of all cultures and colors, so why has it failed to root out the problem of racism?
First instances of anti-Asian racism in the United States date back to the 1800s. The list includes the Chinese Massacre of 1871 in Los Angeles and the adoption of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which led to a sharp decline in the Chinese population in the U.S. Following the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1942, the U.S. government relocated over 120,000 Japanese Americans to 10 internment camps across the country, who lived under terrible conditions for up to 3 years.
The U.S. has a history of not only, you know, discriminating against Asians, but discriminating against anyone who was not white, be it Mexicans or Mexican-Americans after the Mexican-American War, or the history of enslavement, the history of genocide against Native indigenous folks, and the history of barring Arabs and Muslims from coming into the country, or labeling them as terrorists or some other evil enemies of the United States. Every non-white group in the United States has really suffered institutionally and legally from the policies of the United States government.
Asian Americans are also encumbered by another set of biases in the context of their social life, that is, the stereotypes. They're generally regarded as hardworking, intelligent, and economically independent individuals. While the descriptions are mostly favorable, they hide other underlying issues, including racism, poverty, labor abuse, and psychological needs felt by the working class Asian Americans. The model minority myth also hurts other communities by creating a paragon for them to look up to. Several instances of violence against the African American community sparked outrage across the country over the past year. The protests are now being extended to confront the issue of systemic racism and racial injustice against members of other minority groups in the U.S. This begs the question, can the cause be a force to challenge the deep-seated prejudice against the minorities?
Despite a new president and the arrival of spring, economic data from the U.S. continues to be sharply negative. New data shows that there has still been no economic recovery, causing President Biden's approval rating to drop 6 points in a matter of weeks. From Chicago, we have a report.
Just ahead of United States President Joe Biden's long-awaited first press conference, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell made the media rounds claiming that substantial economic progress has been made. However, that contradicted extensive new data from the Fed itself, which found that the economy contracted in February, while their national activity index plunged into the negative for the first time since last April, the peak of the pandemic. The index, based on 85 indicators regarding personal spending, employment, retail sales, and production, has been in the negative over the average of the last 3 months, disproving widespread bullish talk that the U.S. economy is recovering. What is certain is that there was no so-called snapback or V-shaped recovery. Instead, a K-shaped recovery has become cemented, with the wealth of the upper class increasing while the lower and middle classes continue to plunge. Biden recently approved a $1.9 trillion emergency coronavirus plan, but it didn't include a single long-term social program. He also backtracked on key issues such as a $15 minimum wage, student debt relief, and the size of household stimulus. This week, top pollster Ipsos found that Biden's approval rating plunged 6 points. George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump all refused to boost the economy of the everyman despite prolonged economic malaise. Failure to remedy the terrible economic data from 2020 and over the first quarter of 2021 could cause major dissension in an incredibly polarized nation. The U.S. is betting that a major coronavirus vaccine rollout will return economic growth to pre-pandemic levels no later than the second half of this year, hopefully. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei. the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the eighth session of the Assembly. Nuclear weapons forbidden, increasing uranium enrichment based on countries' needs.
الان در 5 سال است که در یمن مرتبا هواپیماهای تجهیز شده از طرف غربی ها میان مردم رو کوچه رو بازار رو مسجد رو.
It is 5 years now that in Yemen airplanes equipped by Westerners have been bombarding the people in the streets, in the market, in mosques, in the hospital, and at school. They're killing ordinary people and lay siege to the people. This is their doing. However, the Islamic Republic does not accept this method and outlook, and therefore, we are not thinking about building a nuclear weapon, but we will do other things. Our enrichment is not limited to 20%. If need be, we might bring it to 60%. For our nuclear cycle or other things. We will move according to our needs. Now, they have signed a deal with a specific timeline, and if they honor the deal, we will honor it as well, within the timeline specified, but not generally.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Faith to be stronger.
They say that they are opposed to nuclear weapons. But they are lying because this is not their issue. Perhaps many or all of them know that we are not after a nuclear weapon, but they're even opposed to us having conventional weapons. They're opposed to us having defensive weapons because they want to take away Iran's elements of power. Otherwise, the essence of the country's need for enrichment is clear. Undoubtedly, in a few years, nuclear power plants will be one of the most important sources of energy in the world. The day when we run out of oil, or the day when there are other functions for it, nuclear power plants will become common practice in all countries because they provide a healthier, cleaner, and cheaper energy. On that day, we will be needing that energy, but we cannot start enrichment on that day. Rather, we should start it today in order to prepare ourselves, but they do not want this. Arrogant Westerners do not want this.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Friday, thousands of Yemenis rallied across the country to show their support for the popular Ansarullah movement and reiterate their strong resistance in the face of the devastating Saudi-led military campaign as the Yemen war entered its seventh year. People from all walks of life gathered in Sabine Square in central Sanaa since the early hours of Friday morning, waving the red, white, and black national flags. They chanted slogans against Saudi Arabia, which leads the military coalition against Yemen, and denounced U.S. support for it. Yemenis say the seventh year of the war will mark a departure from the rest, as the army has ramped up its retaliatory attacks against Saudi targets and made significant advances against Saudi-backed mercenaries. The recent spate of attacks seems to have had an impact on Saudi's policy in Yemen. Last week, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud presented a so-called peace initiative to end the conflict in Yemen, which would include reopening Sana'a's airport and allowing fuel and food imports through Hodeidah port, both of which are under the control of Ansarullah movement. The Ansarullah movement, however, dismissed the plan as fruitless unless the war ends and the years-long siege on Yemen is lifted.
It does appear that Saudi Arabia is attempting to withdraw. It has lost, of course, significant support from the United States for its war effort. So the fact that it has requested another ceasefire, although this is one that has been mentioned in the past unsuccessfully, but the fact they're bringing it up again at this time does indicate that Saudi Arabia sees that it is in a never-ending war that it cannot win.
Yemen says it will press on with its attacks until the other side puts an end to its aggression.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon, but even that couldn't stop the Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. While former U.S. President Donald Trump maintained close relationships with Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and provided Riyadh with abundant support, his predecessor, Barack Obama, wasn't free from blame either, as the Yemen war broke out during his administration when Joe Biden was serving as the vice president. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former President Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia assumed to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions.
The U.S. has always been as guilty as the Saudis because it has supported the war. It has provided Saudi Arabia with billions of dollars of weaponry, which has been used to slaughter the Yemeni people. This has continued. The United States has withdrawn some of the sales that it has made to Saudi Arabia, but it continues with some others. So it isn't as if it has stopped the flow of weapons to Saudi Arabia, weapons that that country is using to attempt to destroy Yemen. So the United States is complicit in this, as it has been from the start. This is nothing new, just because it's a new administration. The Biden administration mirrors the policies in this regard of the Trump administration, of the Obama administration, of the Clinton, Bush, going all the way back decades. The United States is a war-making and war-mongering nation. It supports wars of its allies if it will in some way enhance its profits and power throughout the world. This hasn't changed with Biden. It won't change with Biden. It's tragic, but the Yemeni people are continuing to fight and will until they are free.
Observers believe the Biden administration can only show its seriousness in ending the conflict by placing additional pressure on the Saudis to cease the violence and seek a diplomatic solution. Whether or not the U.S. is willing to do that to its regional ally is anybody's guess.
Israel appears to be in the midst of another political deadlock after its fourth general election in less than 2 years. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's become Israel's longest-serving prime minister after 12 years in power, had hoped that this week's election would give him another term. He tried hard to unite a right-wing coalition behind him, but apparently that has not happened. The 71-year-old's right-wing bloc has once again failed to secure enough votes for a parliamentary majority. His bloc is 9 seats short of a necessary 61-seat threshold. It is now far from clear who would get the mandate to form the next cabinet. If he wants to stay in power, Netanyahu will probably have to build a coalition involving Jewish ultra-Orthodox and ultra-nationalist parties. Netanyahu may even have to seek the support of a Palestinian party, which in a surprise development has managed to win several seats. Meanwhile, Netanyahu's opponents who could somehow reach a parliamentary majority are far from united and are unlikely to be able to agree to cooperate. It is still too soon to know whether this election will prove to be inconclusive. If neither bloc succeeds, Israel could be headed for a fifth general election since 2019. Some analysts believe the regime is experiencing its worst political crisis in decades. The Israeli Prime Minister is in deep trouble because this week's election was widely viewed as a referendum on his leadership. Netanyahu's election campaign focused on his much-talked-about COVID-19 vaccination program and his push to normalize ties with some Arab states. But his opponents insist he mishandled the pandemic. Meanwhile, they argue that he should not remain in office while being tried on corruption charges. Netanyahu is the first incumbent Israeli prime minister to be indicted after being formally charged with corruption. He has denied any wrongdoing and insists that he will not try to block the trial. But critics are not buying that. They suspect that if he finally forms a parliamentary majority, he may seek action at the Knesset to delay or end the legal process.
If he can form a coalition government, he will certainly appoint someone as the attorney general who will quash the corruption charges against him. So, I mean, it's not simply the question of forming a government for him. It's a question for him of staying out of prison, because let's face it, Israeli police have been after him for some time, and they have enough evidence.
Meanwhile, as Israeli political parties wrangle over how to proceed from this point, Palestinians in the occupied territories are showing less interest in Israeli politics. This is perhaps because the Palestinian issue was not mentioned much during electoral campaigns by Israeli parties. The regime has been demolishing Palestinian homes, seizing their lands, and building on them over the past decades.
We're going to continue to see exactly what we have been seeing over the past years, and that is the continuation of a settlement expansion. The ousting of Palestinians from East Jerusalem, the continued dispossession of the Bedouin in the Negev.
This has been an unchanging policy, and no new cabinet is expected to halt that.
Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Saudi Arabia initially denied any knowledge of Khashoggi's fate, as the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told Bloomberg News that the journalist left the consulate shortly after he entered and that there is nothing to hide. However, recordings and other evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalists inside the diplomatic mission. In February, a long-awaited U.S. intelligence report also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and probably ordered the assassination of Khashoggi. But Washington stopped short of targeting bin Salman with financial or other sanctions. A report released in June 2019 by the U.N. Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard concluded that there was credible evidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other senior officials were behind Khashoggi's assassination and called the murder an international crime. Lately, Calamard has revealed she was threatened by the Saudis for her role in the Khashoggi investigation, She said a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her taken care of. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, and Arbitrary Killings says the officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. Calamard, who will this month take on her new post as the Secretary General of Amnesty International, had previously slammed the international community for their failure to ensure justice in Khashoggi's assassination.
Effectively, we see the United Nations is powerless because it is in the hands of the superpower, and particularly the United States, that has the veto decision on anything that goes against its own interest.
A declassified U.S. intelligence report revealed that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, had ordered the gruesome killing of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Biden administration only announced sanctions recently and visa bans on the citizens involved in Khashoggi's murder, but stopped short of imposing sanctions on the Crown Prince himself. That is why the U.S. President Joe Biden rejected the idea of holding bin Salman accountable for the murder. He stated that Washington has an alliance with Riyadh and cannot punish its head of state. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. The U.S. has accounted for 37% of global arms exports in the world between 2016 and 2020, making it the largest arms exporter in the last 5 years. A major chunk of that goes to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports during the same period. Weapons, which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States is protecting Saudi Arabia violation of human rights and all genocidal crime that Saudi Arabia is doing, not only against the dissident, but also in Yemen.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign. While the U.S. benefits from its lucrative alliance with the Saudis, it seems that the green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
Is escalating like never before. When Saudi Arabia launched what it described as a three-week offensive back in March 2015, it bombed and bombed and carried on bombing with the stated aim of bringing back to power Yemen's former president Abd Rabbuh Mansour Hadi, despite his term ending in 2014. His refusal to leave power triggered a popular uprising. Till this day, Saudi warplanes continue their airstrikes, hitting funerals, weddings, school buses, and even hospitals. Nothing has been spared. Rights groups accuse the Saudi regime of war crimes. And as the war enters its seventh year, Yemeni forces are fighting back and hitting the Saudis where it hurts on an almost daily basis. Under a tight blockade, Yemen has built indigenous missiles and drones that are targeting Saudi oil facilities deep inside the kingdom. Analysts believe Saudi Arabia is trying to avoid humiliation and has therefore put forward a ceasefire proposal, the second in less than a year, an offer that Yemen has rejected.
The problem with this so-called new Saudi peace proposal is that there is nothing new about it. It doesn't really go beyond, at least at the initial release in the beginning of the day, the statement of the Saudis didn't go beyond any basic, you know, platitudes of peace and negotiation and, you know, trying to end the war through political talks, without really going into the details as to how Saudi Arabia wants to achieve this. Yes, the Saudis say that they want to help reopen Sana'a airport, that they want to end the blockade in Hodeidah seaport, but there is not really a clear condition that will allow Yemen to really reinvigorate and relive.
A spokesman for the Popular Ansarullah movement says Yemen is ready to enter a political dialogue after Saudi Arabia stops the war and lifts its siege on Yemen. Mohammed Abdel Salam says putting forward ideas that have been discussed for over a year now is nothing new. Yemeni drones and missiles are also striking Saudi military bases where warplanes take off to carry out their air raids. On the ground itself, Yemeni forces are close to capturing the gas and oil-rich city of Ma'rib from Saudi-backed militants loyal to the former Yemeni government.
Ma'rib is located in the center of Yemen, in the historical heartland of Yemen as well. And so for them, this is a very important base of operations. So if they lose Ma'rib, they're basically losing all control over the front lines in which they are fighting against the troops of the National Salvation Government in central Yemen. So that is why this negotiation is basically, this plan, I think, is basically coming forth out of a fear to lose Ma'rib.
Ma'rib is strategically located near the Saudi border. It is the last main area that Saudi-backed forces control. Should Yemeni forces take control of the city, it will strike a heavy blow to Riyadh. In essence, the tables have turned. The offensive that would take 3 weeks has turned into a pipe dream. Saudi Arabia has resumed its aerial assaults using Western-made weapons. Human rights groups, as well as observers on the ground, say many of these airstrikes are inaccurate, indiscriminate, and hit residential areas, killing civilians. Rights groups and international bodies say Western countries are complicit in Saudi war crimes by selling hundreds of billions of dollars worth of arms to the kingdom, as well as assisting Riyadh with intelligence and training for its pilots. Ansarullah says it and allied forces have no option but to expand their retaliatory operations against targets inside Saudi Arabia and to, quote, liberate every inch of the country's soil through armed struggle. So the Saudi war in Yemen continues. Since the truce offer, Yemeni forces have hit Saudi targets and, not for the first time, have also brought down an American reconnaissance drone. It has left many asking if the ceasefire proposal was an admission of defeat by the Saudis.
Definitely is. It is a start of Saudi Arabia coming to terms with the fact that they, I would say diplomatically, that they might not lose, not win this war, but I think it's pretty certain to say that they will not win this war. But this is a Vietnam War kind of scenario that Saudi Arabia has really sunk itself into the swamp of trying to conquer, trying to subdue, trying to dominate and subjugate Yemen.
Saudi Arabia appears to be stuck in a quagmire. Analysts have described the ceasefire offer as a public relations exercise to portray Yemeni forces as the aggressors while the kingdom seeks a way out of the costly military disaster it created both in Yemen and back at home.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aysel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're on the topic of Zina in chapter 8 and how we are able to adorn ourselves or beautify ourselves. And zina is important in Islam. It's something that should be a fundamental characteristic in a mu'min. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, talking about khidab, talking about hanna, فَإِنَّهُ يَزِيدُ فِي شَبَابِكُمْ. Using hanna will increase in your shababikum, in your youthly life. وَجَمَالِكُمْ. And in your beauty, and it will increase in your beauty. وَنِكَاحِكُمْ. And it will give you sexual capacity. وَحُسْنِ وُجُوهِكُمْ. And it will make your face also beautiful. وَيُبَاهِ اللَّهُ بِكُمْ الْمَلَائِكَ. And also Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will brag or be proud of you towards the angels. Imam al-Ridha, salamullahi alayhi, he says, إِنَّ الْخِضَابَ وَالْتَهْيِئَةَ مِمَّا يَزِيدُ فِي عِفَّةِ النِّسَاءِ. Wearing henna or using henna and being presentable is something that will increase in the chastity of women. Which basically means, this is directed at men, of course, that if you were to take care of yourself and be more presentable to your wife, this will increase in your wife's chastity and her modesty. مِمَّا يَزِيدُ فِي عِفَّةِ النِّسَاءِ. You know, sometimes men focus on only their wife being presentable and her taking care of herself and her making sure that she beautifies herself and does all of these things. How about the man? Does the man not have a responsibility for any of these things? There are many ahadith that speak about how a man needs to be taking care of himself as well. في عفة النساء لقد ترك النساء. Some women have abandoned عفة, have abandoned chastity. لترك أزواجهن التهيئة لهن. Because their husbands have abandoned their preparation for their wives. So their husbands have kind of like become careless towards presenting themselves in a nice way towards their wives. لِتَرْكِ أَزْوَاجِهِنَّ أَلْتَهْيِئَةَ لَهُنَّ. This is a very, very important hadith, and it will indeed solve many, many husband-wife problems as well. Now, how about making sure that a person does continue to observe that zina? You know, there are a lot of things that include within the understanding of what zina is. You know, whether it be brushing your beard, whether it be combing your hair, whether it be using perfume, whether it be the clothes that you wear, whether it be making sure that you are getting rid of your pubic hairs and your excessive hairs and all these other things that we've already spoken about before. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says, لا ينبغي للمرأة أن تعطل نفسها من الحلي. A woman should never abandon the wearing of ornaments, of accessories, if we could call it in today's usage. وَلَوْ أَن تُعَلِّقَ فِي عُنُقِهَا قِلَادَةً. Even if it means that she just wears a necklace. A woman in general should never avoid not having any kind of huli, any kind of accessories, any kind of, you know, beautifying decorations or these kind of things.
Ayatollah Javadi Amiri, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Then we have the interesting topic of al-takhattum. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, takhattamu bil-aqiq, make sure you wear aqiq. فَإِنَّهُ لَا يَصِيبُ أَحَدَكُمْ غَمٌ مَا دَامَ ذَلِكَ عَلَيْهِ. Because as long as you are wearing that aqiq, you will never face any kind of sorrow. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, someone asks him a question about Al-Khalakhil. Khilkhal is the anklet. You know, again, talking about accessories, talking about ornamental pieces of, if we could say, jewelry. You know, jewelry. That could be the best kind of word that is used in this context. Women wearing jewelry. سألته عن الخلاخيل. Al-Khilkhal is the anklet. أيصلح لِبْسُهَا لِلنِّسَاءِ وَالصِّبْيَانِ. Is it appropriate for women and young girls to wear it? And he said, إِن كُنَّ صُمَّن فَلَا بَأْسِ. If they don't make noises in public, then it is okay. إِن كُنَّ صُمَّن فَلَا بَأْسِ. Of course, the reason why I added the clause in public is because the whole point is that a woman is able to wear what she wants, whether it makes noise or whether it doesn't make noise in the presence of her mahram. But when it comes to a non-mahram, no, the case is different. So, person is asking Imam al-Sadiq whether it is appropriate to wear an anklet, and he says, if it doesn't make noise, then la ba's in public, then there's no problem. Wa in kunna laha salt, wa in yakun laha salt, fala. But if it is something that makes a noise, then it is not permissible. Now, this could be applicable to an anklet. It could be applicable to anything else, something that is going to attract the attention of a non-mahram person as far as jewelry is concerned, is, of course, going to also be applicable in this particular case. Important thing is, we can understand from all of these things, is it is extremely necessary for us to not only be presentable, for us to beautify ourselves, not only for those in the public, not only for ourselves, but also for our spouses, for our children, for our friends, and to always make sure that we are presentable and as elegant as possible. How are you going to be able to attract people to you if you smell, if you look untidy, and all these other things that we might see in some people? That's the beauty of Islam. The more religious you are, the more you need to be taking care of your outer appearance. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with Mika Vitaplai. In this week's episode, we will look at the illegal arms trade and its economic impact. Specifically, which countries top the list in this trade and whether the intentions of these countries are to derail the government in charge for their own political gains. Data from CPRI's Arms Industry Database shows that arms sales by the world's 25 largest arms producers actually rose to $361 billion for the year 2019. This represented an 8.5% increase in real terms over the arms sales for the year 2018. By the way, we're going to feature an interview I had with the world-famous CPRI Institute President Jan Eliasson. Now, taking a look at the country known for huge military sales, the U.S. The U.S. does not even hide the fact that arms transfers have been a primary instrument of their foreign policy since the Nixon Doctrine. Additionally, the U.S. says it's an easy way to win friends and to influence people. Well, perhaps none of that is new, but it is worth noting why we thought there should be a program on this. Because not only are the weapons falling into the wrong hands, economies, they're getting destroyed in the process. Our first report, a look at an alarming development involving arms and the famous military contractor Z Services, formerly known as Blackwater.
Private security contractor and ally of former U.S. President Donald Trump, Eric Prince, was back in the news, and again for the wrong reasons.
It's that these weapon sales, as you said, got the okay from the U.S. authorities, or from some authorities.
It violated a U.N. arms embargo on Libya. A confidential report to the Security Council said that Prince deployed a force of foreign mercenaries and weapons to strongman Khalifa Haftar, who has fought to overthrow the U.N.-backed Libyan government in 2019. The $80 million operation included plans to form